Okay, what I'm going to do in the first 2,000 years of this talk is show you spectra of every single celestial object ever taken.
basically, Chippewa College one on the other.
Yeah,
exactly. So
I'm looking at right now.
I estimate it to take about 2,000 years, but in fact, I think it will only take a few transparencies. So this is an effort to give you a background on the sort of spectra I'm going to show you. I'm going to show hundreds of spectra in this talk. And so just keep that in mind when you're looking at these diagrams. Also, I will switch between using F nu and F lambda sort
just
of random.
Over so we can see the full.
Oh, yeah.
I don't want to miss the red.
Don't change it. You don't want to miss a single spectrum.
I want to see the red. Yeah.
Okay, well, sometimes the red will be there, sometimes it will be over here. So just please pay attention to the axes on these plots, because it can be a bit confusing. Anyway, this is spectra of basically all of the sorts of stars we know of. Well, main sequence stars. And I put this up to make a point here, which relates to your question earlier, that what you see in general, as you go from very high temperature stars, these are the astronomical classifications of the stars, approximate temperatures are written over here, ranging from 40,000 degrees down to about 2,000 degrees. The main point of this is that somewhere below about the classification of K5, is what I like to call the onset of complexity. These spectra change from being essentially black body spectra with a few bumps and wiggles in them due to very fundamental quantum mechanical processes that we've all known about for ages, to having all sorts of features. These are very high signal-to-noise ratio spectra, so everything in here is real, except for these straight lines. But okay, so the point is, when we start talking about substellar objects, we're dealing with extremely complex objects. The atmospheric chemistry becomes extremely important, and I'm hoping Didier will talk quite a bit about that. I will make a few points about it, but there'll be more general comments. So let's go to lower temperatures than I have represented here. This is work by Davy Kirkpatrick, and this is basically what's called the L dwarf sequence. Some of these objects are brown dwarfs here, but essentially this is a temperature range, and I will try to avoid using terms brown dwarf planet and this sort of thing, because this causes a lot of controversy among people. But anyway, the point is, you can see various features coming and going. For example, these are atomic features here. They start to get stronger, then weaker as you go further down. They're non-existent at the higher temperatures. And all of these molecular features as well change dramatically over this small range of temperatures. Whereas for the hot objects, you go from 40,000 degrees to 5,000 degrees, and there isn't a vast change in the spectra or in the chemical composition of the atmospheres of the objects. So my point is that chemistry becomes extremely important. And this is nicely illustrated here, where some of these features are identified. This is, again, from Davy Kirkpatrick's paper, where he's identified these various molecular and atomic features. The object on the bottom is clearly quite a bit cooler, and also noisier spectrum, so in this case, not all the features are real. But the general point is that there's a vast change between classification L3 and L8. This, by the way, is an atomic feature, potassium, which turns out to be extremely important in determining the spectral energy distribution of these very low mass objects. Okay, so now I've shown you sort of, well, not most of the objects in the universe, because now we know that brown dwarfs are more numerous than stars. And it may be, in fact, that white dwarfs are almost as numerous, which I'll get to at the end of the talk, and might relate more closely to the high-pressure physics questions that people are interested in. But let me show you similar spectra of planets in our solar system, Now, this plot, this is slightly different from the others. This is plotted in albedo, and starting from 3,000 angstroms here, 300 nanometers, and then going out to 1,000 nanometers on the bottom of the plot. You notice that these are even more complex, and there are all kinds of other processes going on in these objects, which we know of from planetary science, such as basically weather, and these sorts of things affect the emergent spectrum. In between these objects and the other ones that I just showed you are these peculiar brown dwarfs, these T dwarfs. T basically just means that there's methane in the spectrum. And this is a spectrum now plotted in F nu versus 1 over lambda, the point being that there's a large span of wavelength here, so it was a little bit, it was more meaningful to plot it this way. So we're going from about 0.8 microns out to about 5 microns in wavelength. These objects are quite interesting for a number of reasons, and they relate to the planets, the planetary spectra, in a very basic physical way, which is that they have a vast range in brightness throughout the spectrum. This is a huge departure from standard stellar spectra, which basically show essentially the same temperature across the entire wavelength range. What I mean by this is best shown here, I guess. And this is, to me, this is the most fundamental physical thing to get about these spectra, and why it relates to planetary interiors or planetary science in general. What this is a plot from a paper by Matthews et al., which shows a synthetic spectrum of the object I just showed you, which is called LISA 229b, plotted with photometric measurements of this object. These are these circles. This is a theoretical spectrum here, but then overplotted are these dashed lines, which are black body spectra. The point is that the intersection between the spectrum and these black body spectra tells you the approximate temperature, or what astronomers refer to as the brightness temperature of the object at that wavelength. So for example, down here in the depth of this feature here, which is a methane band, you're looking at 500 degree Kelvin gas, whereas over here, you're reaching up to 1700 degrees Kelvin. This is a range of temperatures that you're sensitive to in these spectra. This allows you to do all kinds of interesting things, which Didier is really making some amazing progress on, and I guess will show us later. One of the things you can do, for example, is try to determine how mixing happens in the atmosphere. In order to demonstrate that, well, let me come back to that in a moment. We now have a number of these extremely cool brown dwarfs, and this is a sequence of them in the infrared with LISA 229b on the bottom. Here are a number of other objects, and you can see that this is a methane feature here combined with some water at this end. This is also due to methane, this absorption here. And you can see that they become deeper and deeper as you go to cooler temperatures, or at least what we're presuming to be cooler temperatures based on the models. So now I've shown you basically spectra of almost all of the important objects in the universe, except for people, but I don't think they have very good spectra. So, let me place this in a little bit more context to make my point clearer. This is this object, LISA 229b, again, plotted with two, well, this might be a brown dwarf. It's probably a star at the very bottom of the stellar, well, at the border between stars and brown dwarfs. This is definitely a star, somewhat higher temperature than these objects. But this really shows you that there's a vast range in brightness over these wavelength regions. Just for reference, those are normalized to the same units, so the comparison is valid. Okay, now, as an example of onset of complexity, if you were to look at simply this spectrum down here, which is mesothelioma once more, on its own, you might say, well, look, it's looking fairly simple. This is noise, most of this. These are cesium features, and then there's a water feature coming in. You might say, well, actually, maybe there isn't all that much going on in this part of the spectrum. But the interesting point is that at the higher temperatures, there are many features. These are high signal-to-noise ratio spectra, so these features are real. Titanium oxide, vanadium oxide, and then that water band, they disappear. So what exactly is going on here? This sort of comparison allows you to understand some of the thermochemistry of these atmospheres, which basically these were things that only planetary scientists did until recently. Now, the most important source of opacity in these objects is actually one that you really can't see. Which is slightly peculiar, but in fact, what it is, it's a very broadband continuous opacity source. It's due to hydrogen 2 molecules, which form at these temperatures. Normally, hydrogen molecules are symmetric. There's no dipole moments. You don't expect to see any absorption at these wavelengths from H2. But in these atmospheres, the density and pressure is sufficient that you actually have collisions between the molecules. And you induce temporary dipole moments in these molecules, and that gives you an opacity. This is a rather old plot, so forgive me, Adam, for putting this up, but it makes a nice point.
Okay.
Well, sometimes you get offended.
I'll tell you when I'm offended.
Okay, what you see here is there's a black body function for approximately 1,000 Kelvin black body, the size of a brown dwarf, which is presumed to be about a meter radius. And then a synthetic spectrum, this line here, which is, this is an old model, so it's not completely right. In fact, it's quite far off. But the point is that this plot resolves each of the opacity sources into these variously colored lines. The most important one, which takes out all of this flux here, is H2 collision-induced absorption, what I was just talking about. That's this red line. So the reason why you don't really observe this, I mean, if you look at, this is a spectrum of this object, LISA-229b again, is that there's so much other crap in there that is far smaller scale in wavelength than this H2 absorption, that you simply can't see it. I mean, it does give you a general effect, but there's no way to study this in particular. So at this point, we reach the stage where we can study brown dwarfs. We can study their atmospheres in quite some thermochemical detail, which I will refrain from talking about. But there's a little bit in a paper here. I have reprints of the paper line and two preprints as well, if anyone is interested in that talk. So how can we study this H2 collision-induced absorption in some manner that we might actually learn something about? It's a bit strange because no one has actually measured this in a lab. And I'm not entirely sure why. It doesn't seem like it's that difficult to do. All you need to do is get some H2, heat it up a bit, and press it a bit. And
How much is a bit?
No, it's not high pressure.
I mean, this is also the problem with methane. Most people don't want 900 Kelvin methane sitting in their labs. The principle is doable.
I mean, it's not most people, it's most insurance companies.
Well, okay.
Oh, it's just there for a while, it's okay. what is rho T for this? This is important. What's the density and temperature of
it? It's the pressure in these atmospheres is sort of like one bar where this is forming. So it's not really that high pressure. But the temp.
Here, I just want to.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, these numbers are important to give you a frame of reference. Sorry, I should have mentioned that. When you go, okay, there is a way to study this without putting hydrogen at high temperatures in your lab, and that is to use white dwarfs, which are extremely condensed stars supported mainly by electron degeneracy pressure. So this might relate to some of the other people's work in the audience. This is a plot, very recent plot, of what this opacity looks like. On the top is, okay, there are several contributions to opacity over the wavelength region from about through the optical up to 10 microns. And the most important one, particularly in the infrared, is this H2 collision-induced absorption. And that's indicated by this dashed line here. This is for a 4,000 Kelvin atmosphere made entirely of hydrogen. There's nothing else to contaminate this atmosphere. So you get rid of all this carbon features, cesium is completely gone. All of this other junk is gone. And the reason for that is that, well, the presumption is that all of those heavier elements have settled below the observable atmosphere in these white dwarfs. So you're left with a pure hydrogen atmosphere. It's slightly more complicated than that. In fact, what I'll show you in a moment seems to indicate that there's probably some helium as well. But in general, you have a much more pure atmosphere in these objects than you do in brown dwarfs or planets. In the middle here is, for reference, a 4,000 Kelvin black body function. Plot is, you must be in F nu, because the peak is here. And that's just to show that for an object at these temperatures, this is going to be fundamentally important, because the opacity is very strong near the peak of the flux density. This is an example of what a pure helium atmosphere might have as an opacity source.
So you're showing theoretical calculations,
yeah,
based on the Borisov?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, these are, this is from Brad Hansen's paper 2 years ago, or a year ago. These are theoretical calculations of this H2 collision and this absorption. But now I think we do have a way to possibly test these calculations, although it's probably not going to turn out that way, unfortunately. This is a plot by Didier Saumon, and it shows what pure hydrogen white dwarfs will look like as you proceed to extremely cool temperatures, 1500 Kelvin on the bottom. So this shows you that this H2 collision-induced absorption is extremely important. And these things are nothing at all like black bodies. They deviate by many, many magnitudes in the infrared. So this is important for a number of reasons. First of all, people haven't found any brown white dwarfs below 4,000 Kelvin until about a year ago, basically. Basically because they didn't read the theorist's papers. They didn't see any of these articles about this particular issue. In fact, there was a paper that came out in 1995 that predicted this by the man sitting over there. And no one really paid attention to it and tried to look at these objects, look for these sorts of objects. In other words, they're blue in the infrared rather than red. If you just take a black body function and keep on cooling it down, it gets redder and redder, of course.
The condensed matter people in the audience, the locations of these features just have to do with the vibrational frequency of the hydrogen molecule, modified by rotational transitions. So it's a combination of rotation and translation.
And also there's a distribution of dipole moments that you get from this conditional process. That's why there's no sharp features in here.
If I can make a small comment connected with people like Bill Nunes et al. At Livermore and Gilbert Collins and Bob Cobble, who make experiments. And I believe I put it in one of my referee reports a few years ago, and it is connected with that. When you measure the temperature in the high pressure experiments, when you want to infer the temperature, if I'm correct, you have to assume a kind of a spectral solution. and opacity distribution. And I remember that at some point, my point was to say that it's very important to know both sides of the spectral distribution in these kind of experiments for this very reason. You know, usually you infer the temperature from the small wavelength part of the spectrum.
No. Depends on the temperature, obviously.
Yeah, it depends on temperature.
But the system is tweaked to be at the peak for 6,000 degrees. And you're right, we have to assume a constant emissivity.
Yeah.
But I think in both cases, there have been a number of attempts to check that. And it's not perfect, but you can do, you know, sort of like two-color emissivities as a function of wavelength. And I think in general, it's very... We'd love to find these band effects, and we never find them. And
yeah, we never see a band effect.
Even though we've always wanted to find it, because that would be really interesting.
Right. Because if by chance, a little bit of deuterium, for example, is shocked, and you know the temperature you may infer from the experiments may completely...
But we do start at 3,000 degrees and go up.
It shouldn't be very hard to do a radiative transfer calculation if you have the pressure temperature profile through the sample.
Actually, Neil Holmes is going to talk about this on Thursday. Most of the time, the shock is opaque, and so all you see is a sharp rise and a steady wave.
And then you're just looking through the
front. It's a very narrow
room. Which is very cold.
4,000 degrees isn't cold.
It is cold. No, the unshocked stuff is...
The unshocked stuff is called in transparent, 15-volt band gap, so you're just looking through that. But he's going to tell you tomorrow or Thursday about some transparency he's seen in the theory.
Okay. It's an issue, I mean, it's not settled, but this is an issue that has been of great interest, and it's not been talked about, I think, because it's been primarily a no result. So it's one of these things you never really describe in the publications. It's not as though people haven't been interested in looking at it. It's just we have some good evidence of it.
Okay, so what I wanted to describe to you briefly is that we now have an example, well, several examples of these objects. Unfortunately, they don't look exactly like this clock. But there are very important similarities. And
I'd like to mention also that it's observed in Jupiter. It was observed and calculated by three
stars
for species in Jupiter.
Yeah, well, but Jupiter is polluted by this methane and all this other junk.
This pollution-induced absorption by H2 has been measured in the lab to about 300 degrees.
Right.
And the calculation reproduced the data extremely well.
Yeah.
But of course, it hasn't been measured at thousands of degrees.
Right.
And in the theory, Alexander Borisov, who does the theory, it keeps changing. And like her most recent tables don't appear the tables from a year or two ago. And so it would be nice.
Well, you've climbed on a lot. One hopes it keeps improving.
Yeah, I don't know. Often people claim they've included all the physics in these models, and then a year later they come out with something else. So
the first coefficient can be calculated exactly, then the second and third coefficient in the expansion of the dipole cannot be calculated exactly.
Ideally we'd like to have some laboratory measurements. But,
I can ask a basic question. Why does the collision-induced absorption get less important at the higher temperatures?
Because basically there are fewer molecules.
So it's just radiating from a lower pressure region or something?
Above 4,000 degrees, you don't have H2 molecules. There is no collision-induced absorption. It's only below these temperatures where you actually start to form the molecules and cause the actual
overdensity.
Well, this is white dwarf atmosphere. So what is the density? Geo was a typical number.
It's 10 to the minus 2 something, gravity plus C something like that.
And the
it's pretty dense.
The surface gravity is about log G of 8.
The densities are similar densities in the ground.
Right, so you have a similar pressure.
A bit higher probably?
Yeah, a little bit higher.
So what is the density in our units?
Oh.
Your units.
In IRS? Our units.
Yes. So.
it's really six.
Yeah.
really.
I think you should have molecules in both of them.
Yeah, well, there's a question of where exactly they form, but much above 4,000 Kelvin, you definitely don't. I think at about 5,000, it's pretty clear there are no molecules.
Well, very good.
But as a fraction of the hydrogen that's in the molecules, it's very small.
Well, there's this
okay.
If I may,
yeah, please.
This raises an interesting issue about related condensed matter. Is there's a very small fraction of electrons around 4,000 degrees from ionization of hydrogen. However, these electrons can form the H minus ion, and which has a very large photoabsorption cross section. So you need very few electrons to make a large change in the appearance of the spectrum of the sun.
It's called the binding energy of positive ultrasound.
Yeah, true.
Yep. It's
a continual passage.
It is a continual passage. And therefore, very tiny amounts of electrons from the ionization affect the appearance of the spectrum dramatically.
Oh.
And then the ionization depends not only on temperature, but of these objects is affected by density effects interactions with the chambers, which brings us to more complicated kinds of chemistry. And that's an important problem.
What ionization fraction? When you say, what's the number of electrons per hydrogen when you start running into trouble?
Well, it's a question of you run into trouble when the pressure is high enough, or the density is high enough that you have to worry about interactions with neighbors. Otherwise, you can do low-density chemistry. That's fairly easy.
Sorry, I guess I'm asking is what electron to neutral hydrogen ratio do you need to have the H minus opacity be important?
Ten minus seven, or
is there a reason to believe that a small trace amount of metals that you wouldn't otherwise see with a much lower binding energy would
change the story? Very good point. In other white dwarfs, those that have pure helium atmospheres, in particular metals, this problem is even more acute because helium is even less ionized, because it has a much longer binding energy.
Right.
And then you have the He minus, which is the so-called free He minus opacity, which is electrons scattering off helium atoms. And this is much larger than the Rayleigh scattering of helium atoms, which is the other source of opacity. So if you sprinkle a small amount of metals, or heavy elements that ionize easily into a pure helium atmosphere, then you change the He minus by orders of magnitude, and that changes the appearance of the spectrum. And we don't know.
So it's entirely plausible the contaminant at the level of part 10 to the 10 by number with a low, like an alkaline, would screw up your spectrum.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. The atmosphere.
Yeah. Yeah. But you would see it in the spectrum, presumably.
That's not clear.
If it's at such a small level, it might
Well, the thing is, the stars are accreting from the interstellar medium.
Yeah.
And so they have to be polluted to some extent.
Yeah, I mean, I threw around this word pure, but always some measure of purity. Okay, so let me show you one of these objects. Let me show you a couple of these objects. But these were all discovered because they have high proper motions. This object was recorded a few years ago. These are just images from a survey to look for high proper motion stars. And the object marked with the lines is the star at issue here. Originally, they found this object. These are my collaborators in England and published the spectrum of it, which looked very much like a black body. But it seemed to be a black body. They tried to fit a black body spectrum to it and did an okay job. 3,800 Kelvin seemed to fit reasonably well, but there were discrepancies. The shape wasn't exactly black body. So as a result, we followed it up with some work in the infrared, and this is what the spectrum looks like through the optical regime and out to 2.5 microns. And superimposed are black body functions. The one on the top, the dashed line, is the one that was fit in the original paper. And you can see that there's a vast deviation in the infrared from this black body spectrum. These are just magnitudes, you're not used to that sort of thing, you can ignore it. Basically, the spectral data itself is the solid line. These are where the photometric measurements agree with the spectrum. This is all noise. This is a very faint object to work on. So these are very noisy spectral. We believe there are no real features except for the general slope in each of these bands. There are water, earthbound water absorption bands here and here, so we don't have any data. But basically, what this shows is that some opacity source, of course, is absorbing the light here. And the presumption when we first did this work was that it was the H2 CIA. At about the same time, we also observed this star, which was found by a different group, but they took this spectrum here and noticed this deviation from black body at much lower wavelengths. This is about 0.5, 0.6 microns. So initially, by looking at Didier's models, you think, well, okay, maybe this is just a much, much cooler object than the first one I showed you, and that H2 CIA is coming in much earlier. On the other hand, it doesn't match the models, the pure hydrogen models, because there are none of these vibrational bands, the indication of them we see in the spectrum. And this thing even deviates far more from black body. There are a number of other astronomical issues that are interesting about these objects that relate to things like dark matter, but I don't really have time to talk about that. If anyone is interested, I would be happy to talk about it later. This is a plot to compare these objects with each other. So this is this WD0346, the first object that I mentioned. This is a new object published last year, which seems to show some sort of feature coming in. There's no infrared data on that. And this is this dramatic LHS-3250, which I just showed. Initially, what I thought when I was working on this plot was that maybe what we're seeing is you go up above 4,000 degrees and basically white dwarfs are black bodies. Their spectra look similar to this, with the peak moving further to the blue as you go to higher temperatures. It also seems to be true from the models that the peak wavelength for these objects shifts redder and redder until about this temperature, which we estimate at 3700 Kelvin, and then starts shifting back to the blue again, which is counterintuitive. We normally think that as things cool, it gets redder. And I thought maybe we were seeing that effect here, because the peak here is much bluer than it is up here. It turns out it's more complex than that. And in fact, this is such a new field of research that I don't think we really even know what's going on yet. And so let me show you some work that Didier did in an attempt to figure out what the hell this WD0346 is. This is a plot showing our photometric points. Oh, sorry. The photometric points are these little bars. And then there are two models shown here. One is one of these pure hydrogen models. That's the solid line. Y indicates the fraction of helium to hydrogen. So a zero is pure hydrogen. This dotted line is an example of an attempt to make a mixed model. Throw in some helium and see what happens. And that model corresponds to a log of this fraction y of 6.4. So there's a huge amount of helium in this thing. And it seems to fit the data far better. So I think what we have here is an inkling that these models are headed in the right direction in understanding these things. There's basically, it's not just purely H2 CIA, it's some sort of combination.
Sorry, I don't understand why the
law of
the fraction is 6.
No.
How
does this number determine?
Yeah, how much helium does that correspond to?
Yeah, so that means that the ratio of hydrogen, of helium to hydrogen, is 10 to the 6.4.
Right.
So, by number.
Pure helium is infinity.
Yeah, this is almost all helium.
Well, no, but that's a very important point. It turns out that in order to make these models look like a pure helium atmosphere, you really do have to take this up to a vast number, much higher than this. These deviate quite a bit in colors and in general spectral characteristics until you get to vast dominance of helium. So that's a very interesting result. No one had really done this before. And one could think, you could look at these diagrams and think, well, you just throw a little in and it starts to move toward the helium sequence. In fact, it moves off to the side and then comes back again, and it's a bit crazy.
Can I ask though, have you done hydrogen with a mix of one alkali metal at a level of 10 to the minus 10?
No.
But I've done hydrogen by artificially changing the amount of H minus opacity,
okay,
which amounts to the same.
Right.
And it's equivalent to playing with effective temperature and gravity in the shape of the spectrum.
But you can get rid of the bands if you make H minus dominant.
Yeah.
Right.
The other issue with this pure hydrogen model is that the gravity derived from the fit is very low. In fact, I think what you found was that if you went even lower to even on physical numbers for what dwarfs, the fit got better. Whereas for this mixed model, this is a very normal number for a white dwarf.
Can I explain that to you?
That's the surface gravity in log units.
CGS. The Earth is.
You really don't want to go there.
Everybody uses different units. Sorry, I should have put the units up there.
I just want to make a point also following on last remark. It's pretty uneasy to explain how these guys can be so much polluted with helium, because if you pick up a gravitational setting diffusion time, I mean, under white dwarf conditions, as shown by Uwe Schatzman and Edsel Peter decades ago, these guys are probably something like 10 billion years old. And the diffusion time scale is, because of gravitational setting, you should have a very stratified layers of hydrogen on top of helium, on top eventually of carbon, oxygen, and stuff like that. So it's pretty easy to find a macroscopic or microscopic mechanism which produces such a large amount of pollution of helium and
You have to see it the other way around. This is the helium atmosphere polluted with hydrogen. Hydrogen falls from the sky, it's accreted. And then you have all kinds of mechanisms like convection.
It's going to be my point. So the helium is probably convectively unstable. It's probably the most likely explanation.
For this trace amount of hydrogen, you could maybe accrete it just by passing through the galactic disk. However many times.
Yeah, in that case, in 10 billion years, you have crossed the galactic disk something like 200 times.
Right.
And you have accreted 10 times the atmosphere mass of a white dwarf, which is something like 10 to the minus 12 solar mass. So even if you accrete hydrogen, you accrete it so quickly that eventually you should have a pure hydrogen atmosphere. So even if you consider hydrogen accretion, which is very likely, it's very difficult to explain why you still have such a large amount of helium. Anyway, so it's an open question.
Yeah, but it's the fact that you still see,
the only point I wanted to make is that this number you throw in for how much actual hydrogen mass you would accrete, I'm not sure how you derive that. But
I trust DDS calculations, but even if it's not quantitatively robust, it shows qualitatively that it's very polluted by helium.
All the way around, which is the point that he's trying
there to are pure, sure. There are pure helium atmospheres observed at slightly higher temperatures. We don't know why.
Yeah.
Okay. But this is just an attempt to understand what's in the atmosphere from the spectrum. Mm-hmm. Now, the implications of this are certainly unclear at this point.
I sense that that's going to get to those.
The processes that are being talked about here, by the way, which is barrier diffusion, is not important in brown dwarfs and planets in general. This is a white dwarf phenomenon driven by the G, the fact that G is so large.
Okay,
and the scale is small. Barrier diffusion does actually happen in the sun. It's a small correction to helium in the atmosphere of the sun.
Let me just plow through a bit more of this stuff, and then the nature of my talk is going to change slightly. This, I've just completed part of a new survey of 10% of the sky to look for more of these objects. And we found about 40 of them, along with a number of very peculiar things. We found that there are very few of these objects like LHS 3250. In fact, we only have one more. This is it here. This is the spectrum I showed you earlier. So we have a nice analog of that object, maybe not exactly the same, but it looks pretty much the same. The reason why this number is here is that this thing is basically hauling ass through the galaxy. And the point is that it's probably a member of the halo population of stars, which is this whole population of stars. That is an entirely other different talk, and I don't want to get into that. If anyone is interested in that point, please come and see me sometime this week. This shows, and I'm sorry it's small, but there are two plots here. This shows, this is from a paper I'm going to submit tomorrow, so first people to see this. This shows a sequence, a sampling of the 40 new very cool objects that we have, and arranged in what was an attempt at temperature. It's probably wrong, but there's generally an indication of this peak again moving to the red and then back to the blue, and the slopes getting steeper on the red end of the spectrum as you go down. This plot shows two extremely bizarre objects which we simply have no explanation for. We don't even really know if they're white dwarfs. We call them white dwarfs because our survey was cataloged this way. But these spectra are very strange, and if anyone has any idea what they might be, please talk to me. This might be one of these sorts of objects, but the peak is in a very strange place. It doesn't really fit into this sort of sequence of stars. This object is really weird. This is too steep. It's far steeper drop-off as you go to the blue than a black body. So it looks as if there might be an absorption feature here. But if there is, it's really wide. We had data down to 0.5 microns, and there was simply no signal beyond about. Well, actually, I cut it off a bit because I didn't trust some of the data closer to it.
You mentioned kinematics.
Yeah. Sorry?
Because it's kinematics.
Yeah, it has a very high proper motion. We don't know its distance, but the estimate is that the tangential velocity based on magnitude is on the order of 200 kilometers per second in relative to the sun. So it's probably a halo object.
Could there be by any chance helium core white dwarf?
Well, that's the thing. This is exactly what one has to ask for other sorts of weird concoctions of the human mind. I don't know what it is, and none of the models show anything like that. So, but the only thing that comes slightly close is if you look again at these models that Didier produced. This extremely cool object, well, a 1500 Kelvin one, does peak at a very fairly red wavelength and comes up very quickly, but it's still not sharp enough. Our spectrum drops off quite a bit sharper than this one. So I really don't know. But this region here might agree. If that's true, then we found an incredibly old star. I mean, your cooling models would predict it to be, I don't know, 15 billion years old. So.
Maybe it's a question for Neil, but this missing opacity source in very cool white dwarf has been around for a while. And even though these calculations by Didier so far are just pure hydrogen atmosphere white dwarfs, as Ben said, they're very likely polluted by helium. And the question is, could, for example, a dimer, helium 2, be stable under large density? Maybe it's a question from Dave Sepperio. So it'd be interesting to to find out whether helium-2 could be stable and then produce some absorption.
Helium-2?
Yeah, dimer helium-2. Under this density.
What's the density?
Yeah, the density is.
It doesn't matter. Helium-2 is so weakly down, it's incredibly. It's
issue, but if you raise it to, I don't know, 1 gram per cc or something, is it still true?
Yes.
It's still true.
It's microbial. And it's also a giant, I mean, it's like 1,000 angstroms in size.
Yeah, and going up in pressure. But the possibility of binding molecular hydrogen to helium, that's a little bit better.
I mean, almost still, any other thing you can say would be more likely, I think. By the way, in our solar system, this idea of van der Waals bonded dimers is important. Now, that's low temperature. That's really low temperature. I'm talking about very cold atmospheres, low density.
What, like hundreds of Kelvin?
Well, even 50 Kelvin, something like that. In Uranus, Neptune, 50 Kelvin. I mean, helium clusters, on the other hand, are, I mean, they get up to 7 Kelvin, right?
So we're still.
Yeah.
So, sorry to, then you have a lot of other material left.
I thought you gave me about 2,000 years, so I just have, you know, this much to go through.
Oh, okay.
No, it's only a few more. Now, I want to change the tack of this talk now. The question, the reason why I got into this white dwarf stuff was because of this interest in these cool atmospheres. And the question is now, where do we go from here? We've seen planet atmosphere spectra from our own solar system. We've seen ground dwarfs. We're beginning to truly understand them in a very detailed way. So the next step, in my opinion, is spectroscopy of extrasolar planets. We now know that these things exist. The question is, how do we get this stuff? I would claim that this is feasible in the next 10 years, maybe even sooner. And the essence of the problem is shown very clearly by this picture. This is this Gliese 229 system. This is the ground dwarf here, and this is the star it orbits. The distance is about 7.5 arcseconds. Now, in the case of extrasolar planets, what you have to think of is making this many, many orders of magnitude fainter and sticking it in here, a matter of a few pixels away from the star. First of all, trying to see the damn thing, and second of all, taking a spectrum of it. What this requires is very precise control of the starlight. Basically, adaptive optics, a relatively large aperture telescope, so that you can get the resolution to separate spatially the two objects. And one of the techniques to do this is called coronography. I have a paper on this issue here. If anyone's interested, there's some copies. We can make more. A coronagraph was a device designed in the early part of the century to image the corona of the sun. And it's basically two optical elements. There's one metal disk, which is approximately the size of the image, placed in the image plane of your telescope. That basically just blocks out most of the light of the star, sort of like holding your hand up against a bright light source. In addition to that, there's a second optical stop in the pupil plane, or the Fourier transform of the image plane, which is a ring that basically downsizes the aperture of the telescope. But that ring also blocks out some of the diffracted light from the star around the edges of the metal disk, and also some of the scattered light due to the imperfections in the optics. The result is that you get a huge suppression of the central star image in the final image that you create after passing the light through this system. If you combine this with adaptive optics, which is a technique to remove the atmospheric distortions on stellar imaging, basically, which limits your resolution to about an arc second, you can achieve very large dynamic ranges. What I mean by dynamic range is the ratio of the brightness of the star to the faintest object you can detect as a function of radius from the star. As a point of reference, a planet like Jupiter orbiting 5 AU from the Sun is about 10 to the 8 times fainter than the star it's orbiting, if you're looking at reflected light. So if you place this, take a solar system analog at 10 parsecs, Jupiter would be at half an arc second from the star and 10 to the 8 times fainter.
So it is just like a
In this case, it's not quite that large. I forget which band this is. Do you remember, Tadashi?
I think I.
Yeah, probably I. And in that case, it's this will be about 8th magnitude, and this one is about 20, so about 10 magnitudes, which is log 2.5. So. Okay.
Factor
10
will work.
Yes. Okay, so this is what I have here is an example of a coronagraphic image. And this might look really disturbing at first, but
Put it on a t-shirt.
Yeah, it looks like some 60s thing. What this is a star placed behind this metal mask, and then there's also the pupil plane optical stop. The metal mask is shown, you can see where it's suppressed the light. There's light diffracted, that's why this is the spot of Arago. I don't know if you, I remember this thing from optics class when I was an undergrad. It's kind of neat to see it come back again. Anyway, all of this junk here is basically due to the atmosphere and improper correction of the wavefront by the adaptive optics system. But although this looks terrible, and you might ask, well, how are we going to pick out a little planet in all this garbage? It turns out that this system is fairly sensitive, and this is a better way to quantify it. What this shows is three different curves. I'm just going to describe this one here because it's the most important. Basically, the other two are different settings in the instrument. What is plotted here is the radius from the star in arc seconds and the difference in magnitude at the 5 sigma level of a point source that you could detect in the image. So in 1 second, and this is expressed as a function of time, in 1 second, you can detect an object as close as almost half an arc second away from the star that is 8.5 magnitudes fainter than the star. If you run the, this goes as t to the 1/2 because it's photon statistics, essentially. If you run this time up, of course, these numbers all shift. This is a huge improvement over simply taking a picture. Basically, if you wanted to do this around a bright star, you would have essentially no sensitivity until about two arc seconds or so. There's a system in Japan at the Subaru Telescope, which is in Hawaii actually, but there's a system that was built in Japan, and this is what they think they might be able to achieve. This is also a coronagraph behind an adaptive optics system. And here, this is for a simulated image that was a few seconds long. And this is the dynamic range curve they get. So they get about 8 magnitudes at 0.2 arc seconds from the star. For point of reference, this is basically what, forget that. It's too complicated to explain on that. Oh, and also for reference, the best dynamic range successes before this were these black dots down here using a technique called speckle interferometry, which also tries to get rid of the atmosphere effects. Okay, I'm almost done.
To be ready now?
You what? Yeah, it's going on the telescope, I think, this month or something. So it's just about ready to go. I'm also working on a new coronagraph that utilizes a much higher order adaptive optics system, which was constructed by the Air Force to track objects flying over the Pacific Ocean. But it has, it's basically a factor of four times more accurate in correcting the wavefronts of starlight. And this basically shows you the effect of improving the adaptive optics. You get a far superior dynamic range available to you, mainly because, well, what this is a surface plot of a point spread function from the system I just showed you, the Palomar system. It's simulated, but it matches the observations very well. And this is what we expect to get from this new system with this very high order adaptive optics. There's a far superior suppression of the starlight here. But this is a linear scale, and I'm kind of cheating because the scale isn't shown. But believe me, the absolute numbers are pretty good. So the result from that simulation is this curve. This is another one of these dynamic range plots. So again, 5 sigma detection limits as a function of radius for a 1,000 second exposure. And you get down to 14 magnitudes at very small separations. For Jupiter, we're talking about 15 to 20 magnitudes is what you're interested in for planets. So my main point is that we're getting there. And I think that this system, our calculations show that we should be able to image one of the extrasolar planets known from the radial velocity surveys. In addition, we're exploring a somewhat different parameter space here. So objects that they couldn't detect in the radial velocity surveys may come out in this with this instrument.
Which one?
Well,
well, you obviously left that out, I thought.
Yeah.
You got an opportunity to leave it out again.
Remember, you're being recorded.
Yeah, I'm not going to say, but you can probably figure it out. So that point is in here. This will be my last plot. But this is a plot of massive, you can probably figure it out from this plot, actually. This is a plot of mass versus semi-major axis of the orbits of planets. The sensitivity of the radial velocity searches is shown by this line here. And basically, this is due to the length of observations. If they had an infinite baseline of observations, of course, this line would just go straight up. These are the actual objects known. There are a few missing that came out in the past few months, but the main point is the only imaging survey to enter this parameter space to date is a survey done at Palomar by myself and Tadashi Nakajima, who's about to speak to you. And that's shown up here by this line. And this is this object, NESA 229B, which we found before. This new coronagraph should open up this range of parameter space, the hashed region. And you notice there are 5 of these triangles in there. The reason why only one of them is accessible is because some of them are too far away, so that your angular separation is insufficient. So thank you for listening to me.
Discussion during the talk, so maybe there's one pressing question. Take it or, well, apparently not. So okay. We'll move on to Adachi's talk.
Oh, if anyone wants these papers, I'll just leave them up here or something like that and grab them.